The Insights Idaho Department of Finance communicates department news and perspectives to aid consumers in making educated financial decisions and to inform both industry and consumers of regulatory and consumer protection issues.
Welcome to the sixth episode of Insights. I'm Celia Kenny, Consumer Affairs Officer, back with you from the Idaho Department of Finance. Today, I'm joined by John Yaros and Carol House, who will be discussing the growing threat of account takeover fraud, including red flags consumers should be on the lookout for, steps to mitigate personal risk, and best practices to stay protected from this threat and other cybersecurity risks. I'm very excited to introduce today's guests as they are experts in this field. John Yaros is a finance, technology, and national security expert. He was recently appointed as Securities Bureau Chief for the state of Idaho and oversees a team of financial oversight professionals who focus on investor protections, education, and enforcement of state securities laws, in addition to regulating money transmitter businesses, escrow companies, and endowed care cemeteries for the state. Prior to joining the state of Idaho in this capacity, John advised companies on fintech issues, conducted investigations on behalf of the U.S. Senate Homeland Security Committee, led the terrorism and nuclear threat team within the U.S. Treasury Department's Office of Terrorism and Financial Intelligence, managed cybersecurity audits at the U.S. Government Accountability Office, and worked in securities industries at Morgan Stanley. Carol House is a cybersecurity, emerging technology, finance, and national security expert and former director of cybersecurity and secure digital innovation at the White House's National Security Council. Prior to her appointment to the National Security Council, Carol was a senior cyber and emerging technology policy officer at the U.S. Treasury Department's Financial Crimes Enforcement Network, a congressional fellow with the U.S. Senate Homeland Security Committee, a Presidential Management Fellow, and an Army Intelligence Operations Officer. She is currently an executive in residence at Terranet Ventures, where she focuses on cybersecurity and emerging technology solutions, and a non-resident senior fellow at the Atlantic Council's Geoeconomics Center. Carol was also just named the chair of the Commodities and Future Trading Commission's Technology Advisory Committee. I am honored to have both of you joining us today. I feel like cybersecurity and the threats associated with it have really evolved from something most consumers have only vaguely heard about to a more tangible concern that affect a much wider range of the population. John, can you begin by sharing with our listeners some background on account takeovers and why we should be paying attention to this issue?
Absolutely, Celia. And I want to start by saying how excited I am to be here today, discussing the growing threat of account takeover fraud. For our audience members who are unfamiliar with account takeover fraud, it's a form of cybercrime and financial fraud in which a bad actor gains unauthorized entry to a customer's financial account, which enables them to conduct fraudulent financial transactions. Essentially, what happens is that the illicit actor is able to compromise the online login information for an individual or entity. So think things like usernames and passwords being compromised. And then they're able to use that account to commit fraud by sending money to themselves or others, making unauthorized purchases, such as retail purchases, or conducting illegal trades in financial markets, such as market manipulation strategies. Account takeovers are a type of identity theft, and they've affected over 24 million U.S. households. And these types of attacks have increased over 300% during the past few years and cost victims, on average, approximately $12,000 per successful attack. So as you can see, they're a relatively lucrative business. The Idaho Department of Finance's Security Bureau that I overtook is responsible for protecting investors and the money they hold in their investment or brokerage accounts from fraud. And this makes educating investors on account takeover fraud a priority for me and my bureau. What I find really interesting, though, about account takeover fraud is that it's both a cybersecurity and financial threat issue, which makes it important for individuals and businesses to practice good cyber hygiene, which is really just practicing good cyber habits overall. And this will help foil intrusion attempts. But it's also necessary for them to closely monitor their financial activity, statements, and messages to prevent and minimize financial losses. To help our listeners, we put out a public service announcement to highlight red flags for identifying potential account takeover activity and tips on how they should respond if they become the victim of an attack. So with all that said, let's dive into the conversation with our special guest, Carol House. Hey, Carol, how are you? It's wonderful to have you here with us today.
It's great to be here, John. It was great working with you. Thrilled to see you in this new role. And excited that you're still fighting financial crime, no matter what vantage point you're sitting in.
Right back at you. And let me start by saying how amazing it is to have someone on our podcast today with your experience and expertise. I know our listeners are in for a real treat. Obviously, I've had the privilege of seeing your amazing work and thought leadership firsthand, and I'm beyond thankful that someone of your talents has and continues to look out for the public interest as you do. I'm also proud to call you a colleague and, as you know, most importantly, a friend. So with that said, Carol, I would love to kick things off by giving our listeners a greater understanding of the issues you specialize in and your experience from your time working at the White House, the Treasury Department, the U.S. Senate, the Army. I mean, the list goes on and on with your current responsibilities. So can you briefly share with us your career journey and kind of how you got to where you were and how you see your career progression?
Absolutely. Thank you, John. Your career is also incredibly interesting, but thank you so much for that really generous introduction. My background is a bit of a patchwork quilt of different national security issues that really have all allowed me to be wherever technology is being used by illicit actors for malicious purposes. That's really where I want to be. That's kind of defined a lot of the narrative arc of my background. So I started in the Army as a chemical defense officer. What that really means is all the gas mask stuff that nobody likes, but it was chem, bio, rad, nuclear defense in a striker brigade. And then halfway through my deployment in Afghanistan, I switched over to become our brigade collection manager. So what that means is all the assets that watch and listen to people, that it was my job to work with operators, figure out what their requirements were, rack and stack those priorities and make sure that they were pointed in the right place and that all the information got to who it needed to get to. I promise that like the collection management piece makes sense in a little bit when we get to FinCEN. So I went to grad school in security studies, got the PMF, Presidential Management Fellowship, that I know you spoke about earlier. And from there, I worked for the first time in the White House at the Office of Management and Budget, Cyber and National Security Unit, which was being stood up for the first time. And it was really the component of OMB that oversees federal civilian agencies' cybersecurity posture, you know, work on FISMA metrics and overseeing agencies, not only their cyber risk posture, but also their resourcing of budget and personnel allocated to support the cyber and IT mission sets, and really on doing things like the CyberStat program, which I was in charge of running, looking at their key weaknesses, the critical vulnerabilities across agencies, and making sure that we had the right priorities for resourcing to be able to patch and fix any of those weaknesses. After that, spent some time on the Hill in Senate Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs. And then I went to FinCEN to work with you, John, and everyone out there.
The dream come true.
Exactly. Obviously, I know it was too much fun. I did a detail from the White House to FinCEN and I was like, I have to come over. Like, it was too much fun. So I did cyber intelligence work for a bit and then went to do policy on cyber, cryptocurrency and identity, which is where we really see that most cybercrime is for the purposes of making money. So most cybercrime is financial crime, just normally, it's a very early version of financial crime, very early stages, or sometimes it's on the back end too. So some really interesting lessons that we learned there. And then, of course, cryptocurrency is exploited because of its weaknesses in identity. And then it's a cyber criminal's favorite way to launder. So focused on that, was brought aboard to the White House National Security Council to do very similar things. I was running the counter-ransomware campaign for the U.S. government and also worked on our digital assets policy, including the executive order from the president and our identity work, some work specifically on preventing identity theft and fraud in federal benefits programs. The White House has actually announced an executive order that's coming in the coming weeks related to all those efforts and that work that was underway. So I'm excited to see what comes up. But really, even now in industry, still pointed very much at trying to fight financial crime and cybercrime and associated issues. So very focused on trying to find bad guys wherever I can, advise folks on how to better do that.
I don't even know where to start with that because that is just an unbelievable background. And I'll tell you from behind the scenes, it's even better watching Carol work because she's the best of the best at what she does. So you're getting it from the best right now in terms of understanding these topics we're about to go into. So with that said, let's kind of transition into our topic area here. And to start, I think it's important to understand kind of, and I think you've gone into this a little bit, but to understand kind of the strategic goals of illicit actors who are conducting account takeover fraud specifically. And also, who are they targeting and other threats that accompany account takeover? So with that said, Carol, can you share with us some insights and views on why you believe account takeover fraud is increasing? Also help us to understand a little bit more of the goals of those bad actors, which I said you've touched upon a little bit already. And also just how these types of fraud operations are conducted from a strategic level?
Oh, those are great questions. And it's so important to really understand, and understanding the nature of the threat, you've got to understand the both like what's currently being, what is the current reality of the threat landscape, but also what are the vulnerabilities being exploited? Their intents are a key part of that. I just think that your questions are really insightful to understanding and unpacking the criminal enterprise that's coming for all the institutions that are listening to this podcast and that you regulate, John. But basically, it's increasing because it's profitable. Ultimately, this is a problem with cybercrime generally, that that there's a lot of conditions that are enabling cybercrime to continue to operate as a low risk, high reward vector for cybercriminals. That's driven by a variety of things, including the continued prevalence and even growing prevalence of high value and highly sensitive transactions and information being available online. The digital economy has enabled and created these kinds of vulnerabilities that, when they're not secured, are a really ripe threat environment that criminals certainly target. And absolutely, in the age of post-pandemic, post-COVID, FinCEN even published an advisory related to the increasing cyber threat that was presented by companies transitioning even more of their activities to digital and remote operations. So it created a lot of vulnerabilities for companies that had not traditionally been operating largely virtually. So I think that the continued, you know, prevalence of use of digital systems is definitely a huge part of that. And the fact that we haven't figured out as a country and as a world, because these criminal networks are operating globally, how to successfully scale disruption against these bad guys. Mm-hmm. So basically, that issue combined with the fact that there's still a lot of vulnerabilities that are enabling ATOs, account takeovers, is, I think, a lot of the story of why it continues to grow. The purpose is that they're looking to make money. That is generally what account takeovers are trying to do. Yes, potentially they could do other things. If they get access to certain systems and escalate their privileges, they could achieve other disruptive effects. But for the most part, especially with ATO fraud, we are talking about most cyber criminals, most criminals want to make money. So that is their purpose. And I think we see with lots of different cybercrime groups that they are opportunists. They're not just specialists in one type of cybercrime. In many cases, you will see a BEC ring also perpetrating ATO fraud because they understand where the vulnerabilities are related to digital systems, which sometimes are technical control vulnerabilities and oftentimes are really just targeting people and the weaknesses that come from people.
No, that's a great backdrop for all of this. And thank you for that overview of it entirely. And just also an understanding of just how global this threat is, how it crosses borders so easily. I think that's something that's important for our listeners to understand. With that said, Carol, you've done a lot of work leading cyber and identity policy efforts at Treasury and driving similar efforts at the White House. Can you help us understand how account takeover fraud is different than other types of identity targeting tactics or fraud that you've seen?
Oh, and I love this question because I just presented on this yesterday at the CFTC's TAC, which I know you mentioned. I just took over the chairmanship of that. It was a really great day where I presented.
Congratulations, by the way, on that. That is amazing stuff. And they couldn't have chosen anybody better. So home run for everyone again.
I'm so grateful to the commission. So during the presentation, I highlighted that identity is complicated. It means a lot of things to different people. It can be your name, your social, your passport, your driver's license. It can also be your credit score. And, you know, it can be my gamer tag and my terrible accuracy score. You know, gaming, if I were to compete in a gaming conference, I would not because I'm terrible. But identity is very complicated. But it's important to understand the different types of identity targeting criminal activities because the vulnerabilities that are being exploited are different depending on what's happening. So fraud and identity theft and synthetic identity fraud are often talked about sometimes in the same breath as ATOs. And they can be, they should be, because they are targeting the identity ecosystem. However, they're targeting different weaknesses in the identity ecosystem. Identity theft and synthetic identity fraud really are derived because of weaknesses in identity verification steps. So think about onboarding for financial institutions. When you walk into a bank and you hand over your driver's license and they collect some information, or if you go to a financial institution that doesn't ask for evidence of who you are and say, okay, give me your social. And I say, social 1234, my name is John Yaros, and I was, you know, born some date. basically, I could potentially fabricate this identity, and some institutions will allow me to open an account based on giving this information, especially if I have done certain steps before to kind of cultivate creating a credit history related to a synthetic identity, because that social security number had not been claimed or asserted by anyone because they're a child who was just born, and it will take 18 years for them to apply for their first credit card and to learn that I have been building this terrible credit history. But basically, I bring all that up because synthetic identity fraud is targeting weaknesses in that onboarding, that identity proofing process. Account takeovers are targeting weaknesses in authentication. It's once you already have an account, and I now have a credential, typically a username and password for banks, but it could be multi-factor authentication. And multi-factor will mean you have either something like a YubiKey or an RSA token, or for government employees, a PIF card or a CAT card if you're a military service member to get access to a system. So account takeovers are once the account has already been made. So you're typically exploiting a real identity, a real account that has occurred, but I have leveraged now these stolen credentials, like you mentioned before, when you were going over the details of what ATO fraud is. So there really is a distinction when you see different types of identity targeting tactics, because if you're thinking from the good guy perspective, how do I defend against this? There's different measures and controls that you put in place if you're being hit more with synthetic identity fraud versus with ATOs.
Yeah, and this kind of goes into a little bit, I think, of what, you know, I've been thinking about with kind of the new account frauds and other things that come. But also account takeovers can often be used to create new account frauds. Would you mind going a little bit into that overall on your side and just explaining that a little bit further about how somebody can use an account takeover to create new account fraud that somebody may not be aware of?
Yeah, sure. Absolutely. Basically, if a criminal determines that they're successful in one account takeover, basically, I have now either through credential stuffing, meaning like I've gotten a lot of different, you know, accounts or passwords, or even possibly through brute force using dictionary attacks and other things that cyber professionals who are listening to the podcast will be aware of. I've either brute forced it or I've stuffed a bunch of different credentials that I found associated with one email address, old passwords compromised through older breaches and available for sale in the dark net for 18 cents or something totally trivial. And now I've found, okay, it wasn't, you know, Carol's 7 old expired passwords, but the most recent, you know, hack of some major, you know, credit company or something else that was successful. So basically, once I've verified that this now works here, then I'm going to go try all these other accounts, or try common institutions or social media profiles and others to see if I can manage to successfully get access to those accounts. It's also possible a common typology that we have been seeing also relates to account aggregation services. There is utility to these services. They're trying to reduce friction for consumers and provide valuable access and potentially kind of single sign-on solutions to across lots of different accounts so that you can see your balance and easily manage your financial services all from one place. The problem with that, then there is one point of compromise that if it gets compromised, so if you have a weak authentication step, then that criminal can potentially perpetrate fraud across all those different accounts that particular aggregation service is facilitating access to. So these greater points of consumer convenience and friction reduction can create potentially a lot more friction for you if you didn't implement the proper identity controls to prevent account takeover fraud.
Now, that's great. The classic convenience versus security argument coming up there. And we all fall into the trap of wanting more convenience at some point in our life. So keeping that operational security high is an important thing. One other thing I want to touch on in kind of this area is kind of understanding kind of the types of bad actors that are in this space. Can you give us kind of a breakdown of the types of criminals or criminal organizations or even nation state actors that may be using account takeover fraud to serve their purposes?
Absolutely. The answer is kind of all of them on the cyber criminal front. I appreciate that you really hinted at the fact that it's a spectrum of different types of actors. Like sometimes it will be low-level cyber criminals. And by low level, I just mean like not operating a sophisticated crime ring, because it is pretty arbitrary to go on the dark net and to purchase some of those credentials. So they don't necessarily require the kind of sophistication that other types of cybercrime or cyber-enabled financial crime would implicate. Like, for example, there's a different level of sophistication that you're going to have in ransomware or some other kind of like malware-enabled cyber theft, like what happened with the Swift hacks, compared to an account takeover where like I can go like purchase something and with essentially almost no cyber expertise can go and conduct a fraud by taking over their account. you can also have cyber criminals that sort of centralize those services and can also go get those credentials on their own and then monetize them on their own instead of selling them. Why those credentials can be so valuable because they can either use them internally or they can sell them. All this sort of facilitates these sophisticated cybercrime as a service ecosystems that have arisen. But basically ATOs, I mean, they've been cited by cybersecurity firms as TTPs or tactics, techniques, and procedures used by advanced persistent threat actors. And even like Iranian APTs was one that I was looking at the other day, as well as just low level and less sophisticated cyber criminals and thieves. But also you see some crime rings, like for example, BEC often has crime rings associated with it because one of the laundering tactics associated with business email compromise fraud, another thing that target identity, just authorization steps. So a different step of the identity system that's being targeted. But often BEC rings use a sophisticated series of money mules to launder through. So that will often require some kind of network of criminals facilitating that activity. And a lot of those BEC criminals do not just conduct BEC. They will also do other types of cybercrime, including ATOs.
Yeah, and just a couple of quick follow-ups on that. First off, could you just explain to our listeners what BEC is overall, just for them, just to identify the acronym? And then secondly, I think you've kind of touched on this, but there's this idea out there or this public perception that all the people that are conducting these types of cyber crimes are sophisticated hackers with shadowy faces and hooded sweatshirts on in their basement, taking care of things. And, you know, as you mentioned, that's not necessarily the case. And so just kind of want to break that down a little further in terms of how easy it is for people to gain access to kind of things like exploit kits and various other things that they can use to attack people overall. So I know that's kind of a two-sided question, but yeah, kind of just explain what business email compromise is quickly and just kind of the how easy it is for people to actually be able to conduct ATOs.
Absolutely. I really appreciate you letting me sort of reference all these other identity enabling criminal activities because they're relevant to anyone listening to this. Anyone who cares about ATOs also cares about BEC and synthetic identity fraud. But BEC, like I mentioned, is targeting another step in the identity process and ecosystem, because basically what a BEC is, which I could facilitate through first an account takeover, maybe by taking over your email account instead of your financial account, or I could spoof your account. Basically, John, if I were to spoof
Don't
your
do
account.
That. Don't do that, Carol.
Exactly. Yeah. When I take over your account because your password is password or something that I've purchased that you've used across multiple accounts on the dark net. And then basically I hack into your account and I send an email or I spoof an email or send from something that looks very close to your email to maybe CFO or someone in charge of payroll or potentially your financial institution. Mm-hmm. And I say, hey, please send a wire to like this entity, or hey, that invoice that we got from our lawn maintenance service or some construction firm, actually, this is the real invoice. And I will have changed and like photoshopped that document to now have a new number, a new account number to send it to, but you don't know that it's a criminally controlled account. So typically what BEC really is that I'm compromising trust between two counterparties, and I'm convincing you to redirect a legitimate payment to an illegitimate account. And I really hate BEC for so many reasons, not only just because it's despicable, but it's especially horrible because companies may not be covered for BEC fraud the way that often FDIC insurance and other things may end up coming to play, or that institutions will just eat the cost of this fraud, like the financial institutions will. But honestly, most of the time, or a lot of the time, I've seen that the financial institutions don't end up taking responsibility for the cost of BEC because the company or the person authorized the transaction and the wire going to that other account, versus an account takeover, where often that's like, that is kind of a compromise of the financial institution's platform, and the consumer, from what I've seen, doesn't typically end up eating that cost. In the case of BEC, I have seen like companies go under because of BEC, and people lose their life savings because of it. It's a despicable crime. But on the level of sophistication question that you asked, it's a great one because you're right. It doesn't take a lot of sophistication, and especially with the cybercrime as a service business model that I mentioned, which is growing in prevalence and is allowing people to specialize in like one aspect of the cybercrime ecosystem. Some people create the exploit kits, and design malware. Some people will provide negotiation services for ransomware. Some people will literally be like HR and provide a recruiting function for your cybercrime ring. It's terrible what these ecosystems are doing. And basically, like that combined with the fact that there's just so much data that has been compromised in so many different hacks and breaches, it can be trivial to get access to some of that information. And then even for cyber criminals, you don't have to be terribly sophisticated to use what was already a made-for-purpose tool to go compromise other systems and conduct those ATOs.
Now, that's great, Carol. And, you know, I think the distinctions that you made in business email compromise versus account takeover are important. And also just how, you know, financial institutions and the protections that are in place can be improved in that area, I think, is a really important point to make for all our listeners, whether they're an individual or an institution in any way, shape, or form. But with that said, you know, you've also touched on some other things, and I want to get into kind of a little bit the cybersecurity angle of this and some of the methodologies that illicit actors have that they use to carry out account takeovers. Now, you mentioned credential stuffing and some others. Can you go through a little bit more on the types of methodologies that illicit actors are using and just, you know, just fill that in for us?
Absolutely. So I know I already mentioned credential stuffing as one of the methods that we see cyber criminals using to conduct account takeovers, as well as, of course, that they just get like direct access to the username and password one by one that they've either acquired or exploited. But we've also seen SIM swapping. This is an issue where basically with the SIM swap scam, it's a part of account takeovers and exploiting weakness in two-factor authentication and two-step verification, where basically what happens is that the fraudster is typically contacts the victim's mobile telephone provider, and I'm going to convince them, the telephone company, to port over the victim's phone number to my SIM card. So, and then I can use that information so that when I try to log in to your bank account, and then there's part of that two-step verification or multi-factor authentication, which is supposed to be the way that you protect against ATOs, right? Where maybe you get now a text message sent to your phone after you put in your password saying, okay, yes, that is me. Then you get a message to your phone with a certain code, normally a numerical code, to verify, yes, okay, this is in fact me. But if a criminal has gotten in the middle there and conducted a SIM swap, I'm going to be the one getting that text message. It won't be going to your phone. It's going to come to mine because I have swapped the SIM there. So basically, SIM swaps are a more sophisticated technique that some cyber criminals are now implementing to try to defeat even the more sophisticated steps to defend against ATOs. It's still so important to implement multi-factor authentication compared to single factor because it's so much more arbitrary to just insert a compromised username and password. But basically, as defenses get more sophisticated, criminals will also get more sophisticated. So we have to be on watch there. And that's where I think just standing guard to implement other types of controls against SIM swapping, like port protections and other things that you can do with your mobile provider when you first create the account to prevent any kind of changes made to your account like that by either first when you open up the account or requiring you to walk into the store to verify that it's you, or to have a PIN or some kind of password that was established up front and hopefully that was not compromised on the darknet as part of that verification step. Another thing that we've seen, we've observed darknet marketplaces where cyber criminals purchase legitimate device identifier information along with the owner's stolen credit card information, which help to defeat fraud detection mechanisms and fully impersonate their victims. So all of those are a part of the increasing sophistication that we're seeing in account takeover typology.
No, and that's great. And so I kind of got a follow-on question for that. For people that don't know really what the dark web is, I think it would be helpful to our listeners to gain an understanding of what the dark web is, what happens there. And as a second follow-up question to that, something else we talk about with account takeover frauds, and you've mentioned a few times, is malware and kind of gaining an understanding of what malware is. So essentially, what is the dark web? How does it affect kind of consumers overall and individuals and entities? And also kind of what is malware and how is it used?
Yeah, great series of questions. So first, the dark web. I know that it sounds terribly dark and shady. Honestly, a lot of it is. There's also goodness that comes from it. So I will say that first, what the dark web really is it's a part of the internet, if not the part of the internet that we all access and see over Google and that's indexed and easily searchable. It's a part of the World Wide Web that's only accessible by means of using very special software. So basically just a different internet, a different series of networks that are accessible only through specialized software. And typically when we talk about the dark web, we're really talking about these networks that also enable different types of technologies and obfuscation to remain anonymous or untraceable. So basically Tor, or if you've heard of like Tor, is an example of the kind of software that you can download onto your computer and you could access the dark net. You might want to do that on a separate computer, but I'll leave that up to you.
Get the Onion router out, right? And you're good to go.
Exactly.
Yeah, there you go.
Yes, exactly. Basically, like if you have the software, you have access to Onion routing, then you are now on the dark web and can access a lot of unindexed, websites and platforms that are available there. There's a lot of illicit activity that happens on the dark web. It's known for being like the preferred location of choice for child and sexual exploitation materials. Drug and narco traffickers, people selling arms equipment, people have hired hitmen, murder for hire being something that exists on the dark web. And also most dark web marketplaces have really evolved to the point where they're the only type of payment that they will permit is cryptocurrency in most cases. However, I'll also say that there's other stuff that you can get on the dark web in some countries that where regular internet access is not enabled, where you have authoritarian regimes that prevent or make it illegal for you to access these systems. It's a place where people can get access to other news, where people can get access to be able to organize and communicate with each other, for political dissidents to be able to talk and to better communicate without threat or risk of intervention by the illicit state regime. The dark web, through enabling anonymity and privacy, there's a lot of illicit actors that will exploit it. We've seen that also in the crypto space, but there's also good guys that will and do use it. So it leads to some interesting conflicts, I know, and different equities that are felt between national security and law enforcement authorities sometimes, and those defending humanitarian purposes and wanting to ensure that freedom of information flow can be.
I think it's important that it also just shows, the neutrality of technology. The technology can be used in numerous ways, good and bad, even though I would say the connotations are negative overall from where we see. And probably, I would say probably a little bit more leans towards the negative side, but there are positive use cases.
Absolutely. I absolutely stand by all those statements. And since I mentioned cybercrime as a service economies earlier, and you mentioned like what is malware, a lot of these tools are all available on the dark web. Mm-hmm. Like that's the place where these cyber criminals go. That's where these forums are for them to communicate and coordinate. That's often sometimes the marketplaces are where money is getting transferred, including where these cyber criminals are all paying each other. It's where they're recruiting each other. So basically malware is just malicious software. That's the shortened term to mean malicious software. Any kind of malicious code that you end up getting onto your system that ends up conducting a lot of illicit activities like wiping everything or encrypting it all, like with ransomware is an interesting example of malware that specifically encrypts your system so that you can't get access to it, or sometimes will also exfiltrate the data beforehand to enable a double extortion tactic, because they'll hit you for a payment both to get access to your systems and to prevent them from leaking the data so that you may get hit with a regulator action or just potentially the risk to your reputation if the information gets out. So malware is just any kind of malicious software.
Now that's a great breakdown, and thank you for that. Now that we've kind of gone over some of the scarier portions, I guess, of account takeover fraud, I want to kind of get into the things that we can do to protect ourselves. And so kind of want to talk about the importance of cyber hygiene as a whole, or that should be better described as the development of pretty much good cybersecurity habits. So would you kind of explain to us, Carol, why cyber hygiene is important to defending against account takeover fraud? And if there's a framework that you believe people should use in developing just strong cyber hygiene habits entirely?
Absolutely. Account takeover is like so much cybercrime. And I know I mentioned before, it's both a cybercrime and a financial crime in so many instances. So First, I would say that there's a lot of education that you could do, because some account takeovers are enabled through phishing attempts up front. So I know that's everyone's favorite training that they take every year, cyber awareness training. But truly making sure that it's tough training and doing regular exercises and tests, because honestly, phishing emails are getting increasingly sophisticated. And I've even seen articles talking about how well you can draft a phishing email using something like ChatGPT, where the usual ways that you would try to identify that it was a phishing email, like spelling mistakes and like lack of sophisticated language, or just not pointing, not really mirroring or implementing the right kind of language typology of whoever that person was, or trying to convince you to, in fact, click on this link and then I'll steal your credentials and harvest them. Basically, in that sophistication is going to continuously increase, and it already has so much. So training to make more aware your staff that this is happening, but also more proactive security measures like implementing multi-factor or multi-step authentication. I know I mentioned SIM swapping, but make it hard on the criminals. Don't be the ones that make it easy. Like, if you make it hard, typically cyber criminals, like I said, it's like low cost, high reward. They're looking for the easiest place to go to make some money. Don't be the easy ones. Institutions like financial services and healthcare and real estate and e-commerce, you know, you guys are the institutions with really high value, highly sensitive information and transactions that you facilitate that are incredibly attractive to cyber criminals. So I think recognizing your services as part of that risk equation, how highly sensitive are they? And then making sure that your cybersecurity measures are risk-based. So based on that, implementing multi-factor or multi-authentication, I think then looking to see if you see multiple accounts on your networks. Like if you're a financial institution, are there multiple accounts that seem to have the same account details? Might that be one cyber criminal that's gotten a lot of information, possibly from hacking you as an institution, and now has changed multiple accounts to have like one phone number or one email? That's something to look for. IP addresses that depart from previously historical activity are an indicator of some of that illicit activity, either for illicit network access in the first place for the ATO or on the back end for money laundering associated with it when they're actually stealing the funds. You can monitor just the account activity to look for anything suspicious. You can also look for credential stuffing attack indicators, which really means trying to detect any kind of like very, in a short time, especially like a lot of login attempts and a lot of failed login attempts, especially are an indicator of a credential stuffing attack. So there's a lot of different indicators that financial institutions should account for on the cybersecurity side to defend their systems and prevent that access. But phishing people is still so commonly, social engineering is still such a common way to get access to those credentials. But then on the back end, if the account takeover has occurred, that's where financial institutions can at least try to stop the money from going anywhere and then try to stop it en route while money laundering if it managed to leave the first institution.
From the personal level, Carol, I think another thing that's interesting and something that always shows up is just password management and, you know, making strong password processes and procedures, I guess, putting those in place for the average person. What we've seen is research shows that nearly 60% of account takeover victims use the same password on multiple accounts. Could you share your thoughts on best practices for passwords and password maintenance with us as something to help pretty much everybody in society, since we all are doing something online that requires those things?
Absolutely. So first, it's best to not use passwords across multiple accounts. I know that's it's easy to say for cyber security professionals, because users are like, okay, how do you want me to access access all my accounts? I'm not going to remember a unique password for every one of my 30 accounts that I manage across social media and finance and healthcare and VA.gov and everything else. But basically, using password managers is a really great way. So basically then, having your passwords like stored on your device. So then it takes actually having access to your phone to get access to those, so that if it's on your device and then also requires some kind of password to access that password manager, then like it makes it harder. It makes the threat environment smaller for the criminal to try to target to get access to all of your passwords. So using password managers is a good TTP. Definitely not using the same ones. Also using strong passwords. Definition of strong passwords has certainly changed over time, though. And I was so glad that the White House updated their guidance to agencies recently, I think as part of their zero trust architecture guidance, highlighting that actually like having all these different special characters and all those different arbitrary requirements in the password isn't necessarily the right, like that those actually don't necessarily make a strong password. That yeah. length is one of the greatest things that you can do with a password. So that even if it doesn't have a ton of special characters and numbers all associated with it, the length of that password can really be long. So there's definitely TTPs and best practices.
No, that's a great breakdown there. And everybody who's listening, be sure to get those passwords updated and make them longer, especially if Carol's telling you to. So with that also for our people, are there any tools or resources that you would recommend for people who are attempting to improve their cyber hygiene or just gain better, good cybersecurity practices?
Oh, yeah. I think for the cybersecurity professionals, it's great to just keep an eye out for the alerts that come out from the FBI, from the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, and of course, for financial institutions, really looking for things that come out from Treasury, specifically the Office of Cybersecurity and Critical Infrastructure Protection. All of these agencies publish alerts highlighting different, you know, common trends that they're seeing. DHS, CISA ends up publishing malware analysis reports, and all of these entities also make available indicators of compromise. They will publish that often inside of their alerts, which cybersecurity professionals can then take and implement into their monitoring tools and into their network defense and continuous diagnostics and mitigations and information security continuous monitoring controls to make sure that they can detect and prevent and block any potentially malicious or suspicious network activity. Whether it's getting a file hash that you know was associated with malware or illicit domain names.
These are great things right here, Carol. And I just kind of, you know, before we close, I want to get to a few quick questions for you right here. And, you know, things for our listeners to be aware of. And those are really the red flags that can help them identify potential compromises. And we also want to highlight the importance of having an action plan in place for when somebody becomes a victim. Would you mind kind of sharing what some of the red flags are that they should be paying attention to, both from the cyber angle, which you kind of gone over a little bit, from the financial angle as well? And then just what are some key steps they can take, since anybody can become a victim of account takeover fraud? What are some key steps that they can take to address that issue if they're hit by an account takeover?
Yeah. So first, I know I mentioned some of the indicators to look for previously for some of the suspicious illicit activity that's happening, which could be the first step of an account takeover, which is often phishing or something else to try to get access to the system or to just socially engineer you into compromising your credentials, looking for suspicious IP address and other network activity, anything associated with an indicator of compromise that's previously been associated with illicit activity. Is definitely something that's worthy of both cyber professionals and the financial professionals that are monitoring the systems enabling transaction activity to keep an eye on. On the money laundering side, I would say that some of the same stuff, certainly IP address activity is definitely something, if it looks different than what has previously been associated with that account, especially if it's from a different country, then that's something that should be accounted for. There's some red flags for looking for like funnel account activity across like, you know, a lot of different funds breaking out to several other accounts and then coming back together on the other side after you smurf them apart into lots of different places. And then they come together on the other side. That is something that we see sometimes with account takeovers that can require sharing information across financial institutions to see that that's in fact happening. So leveraging things like the 314B information sharing, liability protection can be helpful there.
No, that's awesome, Carol. And again, thanks for that. And just something that some individuals can do. Obviously, if you get hit by an account takeover, you can file a police report, or you can obviously should be reporting it to your financial institution as well. But what other federal agencies should be made aware of account takeover fraud if it happens to them?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, law enforcement is the critical first step. Like they are the ones that are going to have authority to try to stop that money and then recover it and then help you in the long term. So you need to alert law enforcement. Ultimately, entities like FinCEN can be helpful too, although normally law enforcement will be the ones to do the notification of FinCEN, but you can alert FinCEN, the FinCEN Resource Center. Just normally they'll still end up talking to law enforcement. But the benefit of things FinCEN knowing and law enforcement knowing is that there's a program called the Rapid Response Program, where FinCEN specifically works with law enforcement to go in the case of certain types of cyber-enabled financial crimes and thefts, that if the Rapid Response Program is triggered, then basically law enforcement and FinCEN work together, kind of shine the bat signal and go try to follow where this money is going, which the first 24 to 72 hours are critical because often it leaves the financial system within that time frame. So basically trying to stop the money, to work with partners, with financial institutions, with international partners and financial intelligence units to stop the money if it, you know, hit like a wire or an ACH transfer over to some other country. Only through those kinds of partnerships can they try to stop the funds and then hopefully help you in the long term get the money back.
No, and I think that is fabulous because I don't think a lot of people think of FinCEN in that capacity, being able to be helpful. And obviously the rapid response program is a key piece of that. And I think also just an easy lift for a lot of people is the Federal Trade Commission has their identitytheft.gov where they can put some information in and make people aware of that. And as terms of benefits of reporting account takeover fraud, I think you've mentioned those, obviously the ability to claw back some of that money, but I think people can also protect their credit scores and other things as they go through it, checking their accounts and making sure that they're safe. These types of programs can help do that and verify that their accounts have been taken over and that stuff that we're seeing on those credit reports and other things isn't actually due to their own activity.
Absolutely. That's a great point. Oh, and one other thing for consumers, if you're hit with an ATO, change your passwords. Typically what that means is that you got hit because normally a username and password was just used. And in that case, if the criminal saw that it was successful, like we mentioned before, they will then go try it on other common accounts. So the second that you realize you've been hit with an ATO, change your passwords across all of your accounts as quickly as you can.
Everybody, do that immediately if you get hit. So the last question is going to be a real doozy for you, Carol. I promise you that. This is going to be a tough one. But when are you moving and bringing your talents to the great state of Idaho to help protect us further? That's what I want to know. That's what's on my mind right now. You know, that's the most important thing for me right here. We need you here.
That's a great question. I do need to come visit. I have never been to Idaho. But I was in Washington State when I was in the Army. So I feel like I definitely need to come visit you. I know the mountains are beautiful. So I'll be doing what I can from here to help you, but we'll see. Who knows what the future will bring?
I love it. I will use my powers of persuasion to bring you here if it's the last thing I do, Carol. But we cannot thank you enough, Carol, for all your help and all your insights here and just your amazing experience and background and sharing it with us and giving us that knowledge that I know our listeners are going to value. With that said, I can't wait to get you out here. I'm going to force you out here, but now I'm going to pass you to Celia, who will close us out from here.
All right. Thanks, John. Thank you both for joining us today, Carol and John. Our listeners will undoubtedly come away with this with a deeper understanding of cybersecurity and account takeovers, and really an increased awareness of the importance of prioritizing good personal and even industry cybersecurity habits. Please continue to follow us on Insights by the IDOF podcast for our next two weekly episodes during this financial literacy month. We've covered some great topics so far, and we have even more great information in store.
We want to thank you for joining us for our production of Insights, the Idaho Department of Finance. We'd love to hear from you and learn more about the ideas and topics that are on your mind. Forward your suggestions and feedback to our email address, finance@finance.idaho.gov.